The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's seminar, I am going to be discussing my forthcoming book, Principles of Economics, in particular, the chapter on time, which is one of the foundational chapters of the book. My book, Principles of Economics, is being written and finalized as we speak. And if you subscribe to SaferDean.com, you can receive one chapter from the book every 2 weeks. You would receive it by email. You can access it on the learning area of the website. I'm writing this book as well as the fiat standard, one chapter at a time, and sharing it with my readers and learners on SaferDean.com. So if you join SaferDean.com, you have access to the fiat standard and principles of economics as they're being written. And you will also have access to 4 online courses in Austrian economics that you can learn at your own pace and discuss in this seminar, which we're having right now. In today's lecture, I wanted to talk more about this chapter, which is built on a lecture in one of those courses in Economics 11, Principles of Economics 1. That is the course that is the first course that I recommend for people who join my website and want to take these courses. So I would recommend you begin with Economics 11, Principles of Economics 1.
And this is the topic of the third lecture. As I finalized it, I've come to change and add more to it over time. And I wanted to discuss it today and how it inspires my understanding of time preference and how it shapes the rest of the book, how it helps me structure the rest of the book. Understanding time is an absolutely fascinating aspect of economics. It's something that is becoming even more fascinating and something that you can maybe understand with more vividness now that we have Bitcoin, because of Bitcoin's incredible scarcity, which is similar to the scarcity of time. The starting point of the chapter is that time is a resource, just like any other. And it is an economic good. The reason that it is an economic good is because time is scarce. Time is always scarce. What drives humans to give things value is scarcity. The fact that something is scarce makes us endow it with value. It's how we have to start valuing against other things. So time, being scarce, has value like all other things. But there is something unique about time as opposed to all other resources, which is that time is irreversible. There is no way of bringing back time that has passed. And this is one very profound difference. And the chapter begins by quoting Mises on this. He calls it the uniqueness and the irreversibility of the temporal order. And the fact that time is irreversible and the fact that time is scarce and that it's one good that, you know, when you run out of it, then no amount of all the other goods can get you more of it, makes it, in my mind, the ultimate resource. And it's not just my mind, actually. This is the work of economist Julian Simon, who wrote a book called The Ultimate Resource, which discusses this and explains how any resource can be produced in increasing quantities through dedicating more time and resources to its production. And so because of that, Simon shows how the prices of goods and commodities over time continue to decline, whereas the price of human time, the price of human labor, continues to rise. And so Simon shows this in a book that he wrote a very long time ago in the 1970s, but the trend continues to hold until today. The scarcity of time makes it the scarcity from which all other scarcity flows. If we can understand the scarcity of other goods, it can only be understood as a scarcity of time, because the quantity that we can produce of any other good is not determined by its prevalence in the crust of the earth. It is rather determined by how much time we dedicate to it. So all through the years, no matter how much we dig for all kinds of different resources, we're never able to run out of any natural resource that exists on Earth. People have been digging for gold for thousands of years, and we are getting increasingly more efficient and productive at it, and we continue to make more and more of it, and yet we're unable to ever run out. We continue to find more. As we get better at digging, we find more and more and more gold. So with more time, we can make more gold. With more time, we can make more oil, more copper, more zinc, more anything. We can make more of all of those things. But the one thing that we can't make more of is human time. If you begin like this, you understand all of economics as the economizing of human time. We're constantly economizing by trying to increase the quantity of time we have. In other words, by trying to avoid death. And we're economizing by trying to increase the quality and the value of the time that we have. So we're always trying to do that. I do some mathematics to try and look at the size of the earth to illustrate just how large the earth is and how little all of the mining that we've done is so far, to just give you some sense of perspective about just how much more there is of all these other resources. And that the way to understand how scarcity exists is to understand it as scarcity of human time. The ultimate resource is our time, our attention, and what we direct it to. When we direct toward anything, we keep making more. We keep finding more ways of making it, whatever it is. We are always able to produce more of something if we direct our time and attention to it, except for one thing, of course, and that is Bitcoin. And that's why Bitcoin is so fascinating, or one of the reasons, but probably the most important reason of them all. For the first time now, we have a commodity that is completely scarce. It's scarce in a way that it cannot be manipulated and changed. And just like human time, we cannot make more of it. I think using the framework of scarcity of time is quite useful as a way of understanding time and understanding economics. And there is an index called the Simon Index, which is well worth looking into. And I mention it in the book. they carry out some more of the calculations that Julian Simon had done with his book, which I cite, The Ultimate Resource. And they show the change in the market value of different resources and commodities across time, and also the change in time labor. They take 50 commodities and they study their prices from the year 1980 until the year 2019. 50 of the most common commodities in the world. You look at how much their prices have changed. Of course, you will see that they show you that the prices of these things have gone up nominally. In nominal terms, the prices have gone up universally because of inflation. But if you measure the prices in terms of time, in other words, you measure how much time a worker had to work in 1980 in order to secure a certain quantity of this good versus how much time they need to work today or in 2019 in order to secure the same quantity, you see what has happened to the real price in terms of human time. And as you see in this graph here, time has dropped. The price of things like coffee is the biggest dropper, negative 86%, sugar 86%, silver 84%, pork 84%, uranium 84%. This is an 84% reduction in the price of these goods. All of them have lost price. And the one whose time price has declined the least are zinc at 34%, iron ore at 34%, and banana at 40%, fish meal at 43%. So everything has lost 40 to 90% of its value over the last 40 years. Every one of these basic 50 commodities, which are pretty representative of everything, has lost somewhere between 90 and 30% of its value in terms of human time. In other words, with 1 hour of work in 1980, you could secure a certain quantity of coffee. Today, you need to secure the same quantity of coffee, you need to work 86% less. So 86%. So you need to work 14% of an hour in order to secure the same quantity in terms of the average wage. The abundance multiplier, which is how much you can get in terms of the other good, is 7.6. So you can get 7.6 times as much for your time. You can get seven times as much coffee, seven times as much sugar, six times as much pork, and 1.5 times as much zinc, which is over 40 years. This is an improvement in the standard of living of people. We are able to command more resources to meet our needs. And all of these resources are becoming cheaper in terms of our human time. We see it happening with all of those commodities over time. Even though their price goes up in nominal terms, it does go down in real terms. So quality of life is improving. And the thought experiment that we can look forward to is just imagine what a hard money would look like if we lived in a world where coffee gets 40% cheaper or 86% cheaper in 40 years. How would it look like? What would happen to the price of your coffee? It would just continue to decline over time. Imagine a world in which, you know, the price of the coffee over your lifetime, maybe it went up from, say, you used to buy coffee for $1, or from even before you used to buy it when you were a kid, maybe it went up from $1 to $3 today on average. Imagine we'd live in a world in which it goes down from $1 to 30 cents. And then your kids get the same coffee for 10 cents, and then their kids get it for 1 cent, and then their kids get it for many denominations of the cent. This is what it would look like. It's kind of like what we witness happening with Bitcoin today. I discuss the bet that was done by Simon. He bet an environmental activist on many of these goods, and he said, you know, in 10 years the price will go up, and the environmental activist was saying that we will run out of these things and they will and we will have a massive catastrophe. And of course he won, because the real price of all things continues to decline. When you start thinking about it this way, when you think about it with Simon's lens, and even though Simon doesn't consider himself an Austrian economist, when you think about it from his perspective, from the perspective of time scarcity, all of economics starts to make more sense. So once you understand that really the scarcity is not about coffee and sugar and silver and securing those goods themselves, the scarcity is in being able to dedicate your time toward the ways that are most efficient at securing them. There's no shortage of any of those things, and there will never be. If you use your time wisely, if you know how to use your time productively, you can secure from these things as much as you, well, maybe not as much as you want, but you can secure increasing quantities of those things. And the best way to do it is to economize with your time. And so this helps us develop the concept of opportunity cost, which is what underlies all economic analysis, the idea that there is always a trade-off. Ultimately, there's always a trade-off because our time is scarce. You know, the reason there's always a trade-off is because what else are you going to do with your time? You could wake up and get productive, go and do things, or not do things, but enjoy your time. In both situations, you know, it's a scarce thing that you're running down. Once you start thinking about it this way, I think all of economics starts to make sense as just one big game of economize on time. How do we economize on time? It's a very powerful mental tool to be able to use it this way. Victoria is asking, is air the only non-economic good? That's a good question, actually. Generally, yeah, you could say air is the non-economic good, although with modern industrialization, even air is arguably becoming an economic good, because air pollution detracts from good living. It's a bad thing. It has a negative cost. In a state of nature, yeah, air is a non-economic good. But in modern life, increasingly, it is becoming an economic good. And so living in the city has its economic rewards, for instance, because you're able to economize better and work at a more productive job in a city, for instance. But it does involve an extra cost, which is the fact that you don't get fresh air. And so I think it is a trade-off. So it is becoming more and more of an economic good. It's difficult for me to find examples of non-economic goods. Maybe it's more of a conceptual thing. Can anybody think of anything else that's a non-economic good? Philip is saying, unless we go to space, then everything will be an economic good. Well, even if we do go to space, you know, it's not like we'll be able to just command space like we command Earth. It's very expensive to get resources out of Earth, out of space. So we'll see. And Max is saying, with mandatory masks, it becomes even more scarce. Yes. That is true. Boris is asking, how could we go about and compare these results with reality under hard monetary standard? I think you can look at prices under the gold standard. So look at prices in a good way to compare it would be England, because we have relatively good data for England from the 19th century and the 20th century. And you see that in the 19th century, there was an increase in living standards that happened across England at that time, because, you know, the introduction of industrialization and all of the incredible benefits that it has. But you don't see price inflation. In fact, you see the opposite. You see declining prices, or slightly declining prices. You see prices oscillate around a mean when expressed in gold. And if you look at the Bitcoin standard in my book, you see these you see the data there. It shows that prices of goods were generally constant under Bitcoin, under the gold standard. But in the 20th century, everything just continuously gets more expensive. And people have normalized this. Like, people think it's normal that everything gets more expensive, and that's why you need a raise. Everybody needs a raise. Well, no, you don't need a raise. And things shouldn't get expensive. Things should get cheaper. And, you know, your job may, in fact, be able to pay you less in nominal terms next year, and you'll still take it because it is more in real terms, and you'll get over it because the vast majority of people aren't Keynesian economists, and they're not emotionally attached to inflationary money. Alan is saying, the rise and fall of American growth has some great stats on the costs of basically everything plummeting over the US's primary period of industrialization, only the end of which coincided with the move away from gold. Yeah. Absolutely. The rise and fall of American growth. Who was the author of this? Do you remember? I'm not sure I remember. I've heard of the book.
Robert Gordon?
Yeah. There are definitely interesting arguments among many economists that the 19th century was more dynamic economically. And you can find the metrics for looking at that. And I think, you know, we'll see it tested empirically again with the rise of Bitcoin. If Bitcoin continues to rise, we're going to see, I think, a better world in this regard, in the fact that we'll see people able to save, and we'll see value accumulate over time. will be interesting for sure. So the next point that I move on to in this chapter relates to time preference, that what happens when we understand that time is scarce, we start economizing it. And the fact that it is scarce and the fact that it is uncertain makes us value the present more than the future, because the present is more certain than the future. The future, there's always a discount on the future because the future may not happen. Life is uncertain. And so not only is our time scarce, but our time is also uncertain. So given a choice between two equal economic goods at different times, people would choose to take the same economic good at the earlier time over the later time, because they may not live to, there's always the chance that you die before you get to the future. Ultimately, this is what time preference comes down to. It's the uncertainty about the future. So the more they can expect to survive into the future, the more they would expect to value the future, the less they would discount it. So the lower their time preference would be. In Principles of Economics, what I try to do is to formalize my discussion of time preference, which I had spoken about in the Bitcoin Standard. Whereas in the Bitcoin Standard, I was mainly discussing it in the context of Bitcoin. In this book, I'm going to try to elaborate it more independently. And in particular, I think the relationship that exists between time preference and hard money is that we're constantly in this economic relationship with our money, where the harder the money is, the better it is at encouraging us to think of the future. Money is like future training technology. It's something that teaches you how to care for the future. Because if individuals don't have any recourse to money, if we exist in a primitive state where there's no form of money that exists, we have very hard time saving the value of our time for the future. You've worked and you've produced things, but you have no easy mechanism for storing the value of those things into the future. So what do? You think about the present. You don't think about the future. Well, you can't provide for the future anyway. You can't have anything that will hold value from now until next year. There's nothing that you can keep that will survive the winter and keep value anyway. So you eat everything on the spot. And you don't provide much for your future because you don't see the future happening. The risk of you surviving into the future is high, and the risk of value surviving into the future is also high. And so that gives you a tendency to discount the future a lot. Now, as your technology for saving advances, as your technology for saving becomes better and becomes more productive, then your ability to provide for the future increases. Your ability to care for yourself in the future also increases. And so your uncertainty about the future declines. And since the uncertainty declines, that leads to lower discounting of the future. You know, once you've invented a store of value that allows you to store some of your wealth for next summer, you know, and it could be something like a seashell. Once you've gone from a time in which you're just eating all things on the spot and, you know, having to hunt every day, and once you figured out that, hey, actually, I can keep the seashell until next summer and I will be able to buy things with it next summer, well, suddenly next summer has become a lot less uncertain, right? Next summer becomes more feasible for you as something to imagine, as something to look forward to. So you start discounting next summer less. In other words, you lower your time preference. Ultimately, this is the relationship that Bitcoin does to people. This is why people start stacking sats and quit spending needless amounts of money. This is why we see this so common in Twitter among Bitcoiners. This tendency toward having a lower time preference, I don't think it's entirely a coincidence, and it's not just internet memes. It's deeply profound in the fact that the better the money is at holding its value for the future, the less uncertain the future, the less discounting of the future, the lower the time preference. I think this is a very important relationship. If you look at the 19th century and the 20th century and Bitcoiners today, we've got three large clusters of data points that point in this direction. So we look at the 19th century, we see a high savings rate, and we see a culture that we could arguably say is more low time preference than it is today, more future oriented, people saved more. And at that time, you know, gold, the supply of gold overall, all over the world increased by around 2% every year or something like that. Then under government money, we witnessed the supply of money increases by on average, probably something like 7% in the best case scenario, but most likely maybe something like 10, 15. And for many people in the world, it increased for much higher than that, very long periods. So what we have effectively is a large decline in the reliability of the money-saving technology. And so therefore, a large decline in the ability of individuals to provide for their future. And so an increase in uncertainty of the over the future, and therefore an increase in the discounting of the future, and therefore a rise in time preference. I think this is what we saw in the 20th century. As the money stopped working, people couldn't provide for their future. The notion that you could just put money away and expect it to be there for you 30 years from now was slowly, well, maybe quickly, taken away from people. And so people couldn't think about the world of 30, 40 years from now. People started thinking more and more about the world of today. They started discounting the world of the future more heavily. And that's, I think, the general trend of the 20th century was a reduction in savings and a reduction and a rise in time preference. I think ultimately it is driven by inflationism. And I think if you want to see another extreme example on the other side of it, if you look at examples of countries that are under hyperinflationary scenarios, well, what happens then? What do people do with their money? People take their money and literally run to spend it immediately. You take your paycheck and you run down to the supermarket to try and get as much stuff from the supermarket as you can. People don't think about the future. People are concerned about surviving the next day and the next week and the next month and the next few months. They don't have the ability, the luxury even, of providing for their future much beyond that, because their future is far more uncertain, because their money is far more uncertain. So we see this change in time preference happen. We see that under hyperinflation, people have very high time preference. They want to spend immediately. They don't want to think about the future. They can't afford it. Under cases where we see Bitcoiners, where they have a money that appreciates significantly into the future and allows them to provide for the future with far better certainty, we see people are actually tending toward having a lower time preference and toward thinking of saving more rather than spending more. We look at 19th century, we see something similar, not as extreme as Bitcoiners perhaps, because their money didn't have as much number go up technology as Bitcoin, but still similar in some ways. And we look at the 20th century overall, we see increasing in time preference.
In the beginning of your book, in the introduction, you say that you're going to teach basic economics, pretty much ignoring Marxists and Keynesians, because that's what those guys do with Austrians, and you shouldn't bother about them. And I think that's a great approach. But with regards to the topic you're discussing now, maybe it's worth mentioning something. I mean, it's obvious for us here, but since we are talking to a broader audience, there is this whole old song and dance in which people picture capitalism as this crazy thing about irrational high consumption without a purpose. And in this recent book by Harari, that stupid book, when he says, oh, capitalism is bad because not only the production must grow irrationally beyond what is reasonable, but also the consumption. None of those guys say is that they are blaming it on capitalism, but actually what they call capitalism is Keynesian economics, basically. This whole thing about I'm going to buy everything I can is something that emerges from a Keynesian economics, because with easy money, you cannot save and you better buy something now. Otherwise, a month from now, you're not going to be able to buy that. What drives high consumption beyond what is reasonable and what drives unnecessary consumption and rising of time preference is easy money on a stupid monetary policy, which is not capitalism. Yeah, they keep calling it capitalism. It's Keynesian economics, which is right the opposite of what you defend in this chapter. And this is something that must be stressed, I think.
No, I think I entirely agree. Obviously, people at deep instinctive level, everybody from a child to anybody who understands the basic functioning reality of life. Every animal understands that, even without being able to formulate conscious thoughts. they are able to instinctively function in a way where, you know, they have to hunt first before they eat. They realize if you don't hunt, you don't eat. If you don't run, if you don't do your part by running away from prey, you are going to be food. And so, you know, everybody has to work. There's an old African saying that, you know, every morning a lion wakes up knowing they have to outrun the slowest deer or else they go hungry. And every antelope wakes up thinking, I have to outrun the fastest lion or else I am food. And that's life for everybody, everything. All living things are constantly in the struggle with survival. You know, death was not invented in 2020 with the coronavirus. It is an old invention and an old feature of life that has been around forever. All living things are constantly at threat of dying, and they're constantly economizing in order to survive. They're doing their best in order to try and survive every day. And the way that that is done is you economize. You spend your time between production and consumption, and you would ideally like to spend your time in consumption, but you end up having to spend it in production because otherwise you won't be able to survive to have more time. So you have to give up your time on the beach enjoying life in order to go to do things that you don't enjoy in order to produce food. And that's true for the lion who has to get up and go hunt. And it's true for the antelope that has to go and run away from the lion that wants to hunt it. And it's true for everybody in the world. Ultimately, if you're going to eat, if you're going to have a shelter, you need to work for it. And so capitalism is entirely about the process of saying, let's get off the beach and figure out how we can come back to the beach in a much better condition with more economic value for our time and more likelihood of surviving longer. You know, how do we come back to the beach without having to starve in the next week? How do we come back to the beach and ensure that, you know, we are in good shape? We have to get off the beach for a bit and go in and work. And so the entire process, everything that we describe in economics, everything that is the trade-off between labor and leisure, between production and consumption, and how we engage in production through all these many different forms and shapes of economic activities and economic tools that we use to increase the value of our time. So we use capital. We can think of these mental ideas of what we do in order to make our time more valuable. You know, we work, we devise the concept of property, and we realize how helpful that is. Then we understand the concept of capital. We start using things for production. We start trading. We start using money. We start developing technologies. We start thinking about the technology that we're able to use in order to produce. And so we're constantly in a process of economizing. And in a sense, it's like this Keynesian textbook. There comes a point where, you know, and then the 20th century happened, and then economizing finished. And our grandparents worked enough for us to have enough nice things for the rest of our lives and all of our children. And all we have to do right now is just keep our end of the bargain by consuming enough. You know, they've produced all the nice things. And now we just need to make sure that we consume enough for the economy to work. You know, they had spent from the dawn of human history and from the dawn of all life, all living things before us, had to economize. They had to survive every day economizing until the 20th century and the invention of modern central banking and modern industrialization somehow put an end to all of that. And now you just need to wake up and go spend. That's it. You can't. You know, if you're a lion right now, the lion needs to just lie down and have an order Uber Eats and not do anything. You know, you can't be. If you're an antelope, you can't run away from lions. You shouldn't run away. There are no more lions anymore. We're just going to give everybody Uber Eats and tell them to stay home. And, you know, everything will be peaceful. But, you know, if you do that, the antelope and the lion are going to suffer from this.
I'm surprised you didn't use a honey badger analogy, to be honest, but you know, that's all good. Actually, Enrique's got a great question in the chat there, if you want to catch that one.
I've been trying to make a mental model of how we coexist with the two types of lives while we transition from fiat to a Bitcoin standard, from one time preference scheme to another. How will we move from one system to another? Can both systems coexist? I think both systems are going to have to coexist for the vast majority of people for quite a while. And that's in the fiat standard, if you read the fiat standard, if you subscribe, you're going to be getting the chapters where the last section of the book is ultimately about Bitcoin. In the same way that the Bitcoin standard was the first two-thirds were not Bitcoin, and then the third was Bitcoin, the fiat standard is kind of like that. The last third is Bitcoin. And the last third is exactly what happens when you introduce this invasive species, honey badger, Bitcoin, into the hen's nest of protected fat hens that are national currencies that have spent a century parasitically preying on their citizens and not having to work competitively. Can they coexist, or is it just going to be one big, giant, gory Quentin Tarantino movie of the honey badger ripping into the hens and the ducks? Obviously, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. This isn't investment advice. But I think what's emerging now is that the distinct possibility that Bitcoin turns out to be a good solution to the problems of the world's financial and fiat monetary system, to the point that it is not fought aggressively by governments. It's adopted willingly and happily and eagerly. And I think the last few weeks certainly seem to suggest a lot of willing and eager adoption, as we saw with the price skyrocketing. Maybe we get more of this. Maybe this continues more and more. And, you know, maybe the next 12 years are going to be similar to the last 12 years. Obviously not the same in terms of the magnitude of growth, because we don't have as much left in the world to grow in the next 12 as in the past 12. But if we do continue with some rate of growth toward a higher percentage of world money supply, that Bitcoin continues to become a more and more important fraction of money supply, it also becomes a larger fraction of cash balances, a larger fraction of people's cash balances and people's investment portfolios, and effectively protects people from credit defaults. The fiat credit system just can't make more credit anymore, because everybody's up to their eyeballs in debt. And so you can't make enough debt for investors. I think this is really the key thing, that there are no more borrowers left. Everybody is up to their eyeballs in debt already. Nobody can borrow more. Every ounce of income, every dime of income in the future has already been securitized into and borrowed against in the present. So the reason there's so much demand for securitization and for lending and credit is because people need a store of value. People wanted mortgage-backed securities because they didn't have Bitcoin in 2008. People have wanted all this investment junk that people have invested in over the last, interesting question, how long, 20, 30, 50, 100 years. It's interesting to speculate how long the malinvestment bubble has gone on, and not impossible to make the argument that it's been an entire century of malinvestment that needs to be liquidated. Obviously not everything, but a big chunk of it. The lack of supply of credit as investable assets for people. So, you know, you can't just invest in holding money. Since you can't, you don't have enough money, you don't have cash balances, people need to hold stocks and bonds and debt instruments and all these things as a store of value. And I think the case for coexistence is central banks don't know what to do in order to provide their domestic citizens with savings for the future that hold on to value. They have to keep their savers in assets that are continuously getting depreciated. And Bitcoin fixes this. Bitcoin allows everybody to supplement their portfolio with NGU technology and protect themselves from the devaluation of the real value of their financial portfolios over time. It could be that Bitcoin is the investable asset that takes pressure off the credit creation system. Instead of the credit markets all over the world collapsing into one giant heap of hyperinflationary or hyperdeflationary apocalypse, maybe Bitcoin just continues to grow larger than the entirety of the fiat credit market. And effectively, people individually upgrade from Betamax to DVD, if you want, from central bank to Bitcoin. People's cash balances upgrade one at a time, you know, depending on when they get Bitcoin and when it works for them. And so they start adopting it, and then they start accumulating more and more of it over time. Bitcoin's needed, and we're going to have Preston on the next seminar on Monday. Maybe Bitcoin is the answer. Maybe, you know, what do you do with all of these? So there's so much money out there that's tied to the stock market that needs more government printing. And so they keep printing, they can't prevent bubbles forever. Bubbles will blow up. And so this is the late stage fiat Keynesian experiment. This is the point where Keynes said we shouldn't worry about because we're all going to be dead. Well, now, you know, we have to worry about it. So now, you know, when we're comparing hard money to fiat, it's not 1930 anymore, where we've got centuries of accumulated capital in our savings. Effectively, we've got healthy, strong balance sheets full of hard money with zero liability that have been accumulating for centuries. In that situation, if we abuse these a little bit for a little bit of inflation, for war or whatever, it's like you're taking a little bit of a push. But now we're at a point where the fiat system is, it can tap into more real capital because instead of actual hard money stored on people's balance sheets, everybody has got toxic inflationary debt. Everybody's holding other people's bags, basically. And if everybody defaults, everybody else defaults. And so it's becoming quite ugly from the perspective of how it's going to unfold. And we see how it's, you know, politically how it's going is that, you know, there is a new financial apartheid that develops between the people who have hard assets. Like if you had hard assets before 2018, and people who didn't have hard assets before 2018 or 2019. And I think, well, 2020 really is the hard answer. I think if you didn't have them by 2020, inflation is going to be massively destructive for you. People who have hard assets will weather the inflation storm better. And so it's been many decades of this policy leading in this way, but the combination now is just going to lead to so much economic disparity between people who have hard assets and people who just have inflation. I don't know, maybe Bitcoin fixes this. Maybe Bitcoin is going to be the answer. Like eventually everybody likes NGU technology. Everybody is going to be interested in it, maybe. And maybe it doesn't have to be so gruesome. We'll see. I could be delusional, by the way, so we never know.
I don't know. Everything's seeming pretty gruesome right now.
Yeah, well, at least, you know, at least we have Bitcoin. We have the fix brewing. We have a replacement to all of the underlying structural problems of fiat. We have the vaccine, basically, and it's being deployed. And its level of deployment over the last few weeks has gone up massively. Help us inoculate the world against fiat by spreading Bitcoin.
I'm sure you know Jesus Huerta de Soto. Explains the business cycle theory as a particular case of the Mises-Chien theorem of impossibility of calculation under socialism. And he explained that the business cycle is produced by discoordinations between agents not having good prices to coordinate their action. And could we frame what you spoke about regarding time preference in the same manner? Isn't unsound money a kind of discoordination, not between different agents in the present, but between us in the present and our future selves, a kind of illusion that is spread about what level of abundance we have in the present and we can expect to have in the future?
De Soto's explanation of the business cycle as Misesian calculation, I think, is absolutely correct. And if you read the first draft of Principles of Economics, you see how, in my mind, you know, we build the understanding of various foundational concepts in economics. What is capital and what is marginal analysis and what is trade and what is money? All of that in order to arrive at the chapters on the market system. What is the market system? What is the market economy? It's the crowning achievement of Austrian economics. It's methodical analysis, one step at a time. What is labor? What is production? What is capital? What is trade? All of that. And then you build the building blocks of an economy from the basic concepts into developing a very vivid image of how the market economy works, which is what Mises does in Human Action, and what Rothbard does in Man, Economy, and State, two textbooks on which I'm basing my textbook the most, as well as Menger's Principles of Economics. What they do, what they develop, is this understanding of this market system as a place where people are engaged in economic calculation because of the presence of money. So because we have money, because we've developed this sophisticated concept called money, and now everybody knows how to use it. We developed the concept of entrepreneurship. We developed the concept of economic production. We understand those things, and people grow into those things and live in an extended order where these things are taken for granted. We engage in this thing called market order. The thing that makes this thing tick, and this is really the crowning achievement of Mises' work and of the analytical power of Austrian economics, is to understand economic calculation. This is such an important point, and it's such an ignored point. So few people understand it. And once you understand that, you know, everything follows. The Austrian business cycle is a special application of the calculation problem. The failure of socialism is just an application of the calculation problem. Basically, all dysfunctions that can happen in the market economy can happen when you distort and disfigure the process of economic calculation, because it's the glue that holds the market system together. The market, or maybe, you know, it's the oil that keeps the wheels humming, maybe is a better expression, in that, well, it's more than just the oil. It's the wheels themselves, maybe. It's the engine. I should stop with the metaphors and just get to the point. The calculation is itself, yes, more important than the metaphors is the functional explanation of why this is important. It's important because the application of economic calculation, once people are able to do math, because there is a price, there is a one common medium of exchange, and the price of everything is expressed as a function of this medium of exchange, people are able to perform calculations on economic goods. They're able to measure their value against one another, and they're able to decide on the most productive and most valuable uses of capital goods for themselves. When you understand that this is the life force of an economic system, this is what keeps the economy working, then you can see how if you were to mess with the money supply, if you were to alternate the money supply, then yes, bad things would happen. And what are those bad things? Well, let's think about methodically and look at business cycles, and we see this exactly what would happen. People perform erroneous calculation and they miscalculate the availability of capital. They invest in projects for which they don't have enough capital. And this appears to be profitable initially when they get the loans, but then a few years down the line, it falls apart. So it is a failure of calculation. It's a failure of calculation because of a failure of effectively private property. Ultimately, the basic premise of calculation is that the owner of the good needs to be calculating, because they need to be the one making the decision, because they need to lose it if they misuse it. That's really ultimately why capitalism works, because you only have capital in the hands of people that are able to make good decisions, because if they make bad decisions, they lose their capital. The distortions that happen to individual lives because of the distortion of time preference caused by effectively the destruction of money through the 20th century by raising the supply growth rate of money from 2% per year to 5% per year, or effectively going from a stock to flow ratio of 50, 60, or 70 under gold to a stock to flow ratio of 10, 15, 20 under fiat, or maybe much lower than 10 even. That really ruins our ability to provide for our future. You can understand a lot of the problems of the world as failure of economic calculation because of the distortion of time preferences by central banks. The reason people do stupid things in many cases is because they don't think about the future. And the reason they've been trained not to think about the future is because the most advanced technology that we've had for hundreds of years for money has been destroyed. And we've gone back to something more primitive, something similar to maybe seashells or these other kinds of primitive monies, because we don't have a hard money. If you think about the distortions that this does to us, it's amazing.
Yeah, totally understand. I totally agree. The more I go down the rabbit hole of Austrian economics, the more I am under the impression that it's basically one lesson, which is, as you say, economic calculation, that you can follow in various ramifications and explain economic phenomena from that base. But this leads to another question, maybe. Many people are under the impression that our technological capabilities, availability of resources are more important to build a prosperous future than the good coordinations and the good between agents and the good allocation of these resources in itself. How would you explain to someone that maybe is not well trained in economics that actually the way we act in a given setup is more important for our prosperity than just the level of technological development we enjoy and the availability of resources and stuff like that, that's on which people usually focus?
The underlying message of principles of economics, and one of the most profound lessons that you learn from Austrian economics is, you know, what I was describing earlier about building all of these building blocks of economics to use them to understand what economics and economic calculation is and to understand the market system. The other important thing you understand from it is just what the process of civilization is. And the process of civilization is the ability to perform this stuff, this economic order and this economic calculation, to be able to do this for generations, wherein they're all able to engage in capital accumulation and they're all able to engage in all of these modes of economizing. And if you look at what has happened, if you look at human history, like you see this idea that once people have several decades of peace, you start witnessing time preference dropping and then people start providing for the future. And after several generations of capital accumulation, several generations of stability and peace and so on, you're able to reach a level where you have civilization, the high civilization, and you can think about this in real economic terms, wherein, you know, it's a world in which people are able to provide their children with a better standard of living materially, where we're constantly accumulating more capital. Everybody's always saving, more capital is accumulating. And as a result, the standard of living improves. And as a result, the problems that my parents had to deal with are not problems that my children have to deal with. And so my children get a better life than the one that I was given. And life continues to improve in that way. And even if you may not think that this is all that important, like who cares, maybe my kids just shouldn't live much better than me. It doesn't matter. Even if you think of it this way, I think one way to think about it is that moving forward, this is what I would argue in response to what your question is, moving forward is the only way to not move backward, basically, in this regard. In other words, it's only if you're able to accumulate capital and if you're able to continue to improve economically, only then can you have a peaceful and prosperous society where people are engaged in productive action rather than engaged in violent predation on each other. They're not animals that are constantly attacking each other. They're peaceful human beings working together to achieve goals for themselves and for their children. And so they realize that cooperation is a better outcome. So I think it's a much more profound treatment of economics. And what you learn in Austrian economics is much more profound than what you learn from regular mainstream economics, because it shows you that the foundations of a market economy are not just important because they give us a lot of cheap good goods, because it gives us a lot of nice plastic toys. It's important because it's the foundation for human survival and human civilization and human ability to coexist peacefully in large settlements that are protected from nature. And when you see economic order break down, you know, you see how nature becomes a gruesome enemy of humans, where nature can just do things that are terrible for humans, which we take for granted if we live in civilization. But we take those things for granted only because we have an extensive market order that allows for the production of those things. The reason that we have advanced homes that wherein rain is not an issue and wind is not an issue, the reason that we have we can stay warm in the winter, the reason that we have modern technology and information technology, the reason we have all of that stuff is because we have the extended market order. And if we break down the extended market order, it's not just that we run out of, you know, nice toys. No, we run out of all of the things that we need for survival. We break down. It becomes harder to build your house. It becomes much more expensive to build houses. It becomes much, 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 much harder and much more expensive to survive winter,
And you see this happening in places that have hyperinflation around the world these days. And you can see the reverse process. You know, you just think about economic development, just how much it made life more certain and less uncertain, less violent and less likely to end badly quickly for people. You see that, I think, because of civilization, because of this extended market order. So I think you may have trouble accepting it intellectually. And you know, people, and this is honestly why I don't really take socialist and leftist and Marxist thinkers who are opposed to the market economy very seriously. You cannot take the somebody who's opposed to the market economy seriously if everything that they do is part of the market economy. If they can't, and nobody is forcing them to do it. If you don't like the market economy, you don't have to live in the market economy. You don't have to live in a house that was built by strangers coordinating themselves with the market economy. You know, trade is the market economy. So if you live in a house that you haven't built with your own bare hands, then you're being an evil capitalist. If you accumulate capital, if you have a house, if you have a phone, if you have a laptop, if you have a car, all of that, if you use that for production, you're accumulating capital. Capitalism is the natural order, and humans resort to it in 99% of all humans resort to it in 99% of all the things that they do. Only a very tiny fraction of people are able, thanks to the gifts of capitalism and thanks to the security provided to us by capitalism, by capital accumulation. The last couple of centuries, a new class of human beings have developed where they are so detached from the realities of survival, thanks to capitalism, where they no longer appreciate the underlying reality of survival of, you know, you need to work and we also, you know, modern survival. In order to survive, you need to work. But in order to have modern life, you need a large extended market order of billions of people. You know, if we want to have laptops, we need market economies of billions of people using laptops. This is the only way that it's possible for us to buy our laptops at a few $100s or a few $1,000s, essentially a few hours of wages or several hours of wages. Computers would be far more expensive if we didn't have a market economy, if we had less trade, if we had less capital accumulation. We can't have any computers because we need capital to build them. So everybody is a capitalist. Everybody understands this on the real sense when it comes to, you know, surviving winter. Everybody wants to benefit from the market economy. Nobody is a skeptic. Nobody is anti-capitalist when it comes to living in a house that was built by capitalists. Everybody lives in houses. Everybody uses machines. And, you know, all of these hypocrites who think that they're anti those things, nothing is stopping them from going and living in places where there's no civilization, there's no capitalism. You know, you just go anywhere in the Americas or in Africa or in Europe or in Asia, all over the world, you will find places that are just isolated and deserted, and you could go and get lost there, and you know, nobody will find you. Nobody will bother you. Maybe somebody will chance across you, but you know, you don't have to be part of capitalism. That's what life means without capitalism. It's the absence of all the things that make life less uncertain and that make the quality of our time much better. All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining. And remember Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S., we are going to have Preston Pish join us to discuss Bitcoin bull markets. Thank you all for joining, and I will see you next Monday. Take care.